Creating your own reality. Is it possible for me? I am Jennifer K. Hill, the Consciousness Architect, and I am here to tell you that it's not only possible, it's closer than you might think. Welcome to the show. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Regarding Consciousness. Without further ado, we're going to dive in today with our thought leader, author, and spiritual teacher friend, Dr. Carlos Waters, who's here with us today. Dr. Waters has won numerous global awards for his work, including the Pax Mundi Award and the UN Peace Messenger Award, among many others. He has authored 22 books and is in the process of writing his most recent book, which we will talk about a little bit today. And it has been published in 6 languages and translated into 9 different languages. He has dedicated himself to the study of human consciousness and the integration of psychology and spirituality in a non-dualistic paradigm called psychosynergy. For over 50 years, Dr. Waters has extensively researched the theory and application of psychedelics and medicine. Dr. Waters, I'm so grateful that our mutual friend Justin had introduced us and grateful to have you sharing your beautiful wisdom with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I was smitten about your journey. It was so funny, the series of serendipities that brought us together. So Justin Breen, thank you. Shout out to Justin, who had introduced us, not knowing that I grew up, born and raised, not 10, 20 minutes from where you now live in Vista, California. And then it turned out that we both had very serendipitous journeys throughout our lives. I would love, before we dive into the consciousness story, would you mind sharing the Pablo Neruda story? I've shared that story with so many people since you and I met. I just think it's such a beautiful story of the way that the universe unfolds when we have a path that's laid out before us. Could you share that story with us?
Absolutely. Thank you for eliciting it. This happened 55 years ago, almost. I had been in a relationship, a love affair that really opened me up to dimensions of loving that I didn't know before. I was in my very early 20s. And I had kept a journal of this adventure. A friend of mine, without telling me, took a copy of this, Xerox it or whatever it was, mimeograph of those days, and gave it to Pablo Neruda, who at that time was a Chilean presidential candidate, a communist, and a mystic at the same time, out of his experiences in India and Far East Asia in the 30s and 40s. I didn't know anything till one day I get a phone call, and with a melodious voice, someone at the other side says, "Carlos, yes, who is this? This is Pablo." "Pablo who?" "Pablo Neruda." A very melodious voice. I will never forget. I was staying in the room that I had in my parents' house. I looked out. There was a park across the street. I have the imagery of even the blankets that were on the bed. I was so struck by emotion, positive emotion, of course. I said, "Yes, Mr. Neruda." And he says, "Just call me Pablo. I have read your work." I didn't even know what he was talking about. "And it deserves to be published. I got you a publishing press. I wrote you a preface. And you just have to send to pick it up and get the connections." And this was my first book, 1970. August of 1970, it came out, and it was an instant bestseller. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was a bestseller because it was prefaced by Pablo Neruda. And I had all kinds of propaganda and criticism for and against this. The people that were in his mindset were for, and the extreme right wing was against, because what was I doing? An intern in medical school at the time, exploring metaphysical adventures. And I was yesterday actually thinking that I have translated the book into English. It's never been translated. There have been many printings in Spanish. And for the 55th anniversary, I would like to release it.
I can't wait to read it. My Spanish is good. It's un poco. Estudio español en la escuela, pero I don't know if I could get through the whole book and understand the nuances without it being in English. So I hope you do that.
Yes. I'm in the process of it. It's pretty advanced. I just have to reshuffle the foreword, because a foreword for 1970 is not the foreword for 2025.
Yes.
Which is 55 years. Where are those 55 years gone? I don't have the foggiest idea.
What I love, one of these many serendipities. So you now live like 20 minutes from my hometown. And my mother, the reason I was so smitten with the story is when I was a young girl, my mother was obsessed with Pablo Neruda because he was this prolific poet. He was, in fact, her favorite poet, so much so that when she went to Chile, she visited both his homes and went on these treks and pilgrimages just because she was so inspired. And of course, there was the famous, I think it was Oscar award-winning movie, Il Postino, which popularized Neruda's work even further in the 1990s. So I start with a story, Carlos, because there is no accident in life. What are the odds that your friend, that you would have this mythical romance with this person that then gets written down and eventually winds up in the hands of Pablo Neruda? What does consciousness have to do with this? Why do you think that was your journey, Carlos?
Well, that's a very difficult question because how do I know the why? But I know that I accepted it and I navigated that journey. And that for me, it was like discovering an organ, a new heart that was there but wasn't activated. That loving experience, plus the, as you say, the coincidences that ensued after that were not coincidences. They set me on a completely different path. As a matter of fact, you mentioned psychedelics, and this is 1970, and I was at the university clinic in Santiago. I wrote another book, a very short poetry book called Fragments 1970. And when I took it to this other publisher, he looked at it and he said, "Did you write this under the influence of psychedelics?" And I said, "No, how dare you? I'm a serious medical student and future doctor who doesn't do those things." And he looks at me from under his glasses and says, "You should try." And I was very curious, and curiosity guided me to a next chapter, which was to meet this couple. She was a doctor and he was an artist. They were running groups. And these groups were extraordinary. They opened me up to a completely different reality. So that my goal of being a dean of a medical school evaporated. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be a dean in my own life, not in a medical school. And it completely shifted my whole journey. Soon after that, I was in the States. Soon after that, I was living for almost a year in Morocco. Mm-hmm. With the Sufis, the mystics of Islam. And one thing led to the next. I have another book called Recovery of the Sacred. And in that, the story of whatever happened to me before I turned 30 is placed with lessons and awareness.
I think it's a beautiful tale that the path we sometimes endeavor to begin on twists and turns in unexpected ways. So you started off wanting to be a medical doctor, went on to be a psychiatrist, went on to be a best-selling author, and of course now facilitating all sorts of work around psychedelia, among other things. And I think it's important that we share these stories, Carlos, because so often you see somebody who's had a modicum of success and you think that, oh, it was so easy for them. Their path was laid out. And yet oftentimes, just like your journey so beautifully illustrates to us, we don't always go down a straight line of from point A to point B of how we get to where we're going. I remember years ago when I was writing my first book, I had the privilege and honor of interviewing the most famous photographer in the world, Chase Jarvis. And Chase, at the time I was writing a book about how to find your dream job, and here's Chase, who is the top photographer in the entire world at that point when I had interviewed him, I think in 2012. And Chase shared a similar story where it's like he started off and wanted to please his parents. So he was an athlete and a soccer, or what they call football player. And then midway through that, he realized he's, oh, as good as he was at it, as he was at it, it didn't fill his soul. So then he thought, oh, I'll go be a doctor because that'll make my parents proud of me, and goes down the path and is completing medical school. And then something is just pulling at our souls. There's those heartstrings that we have, our soul, our higher self, our inner wisdom, whatever you choose to call it. And so the story went on. And one day Chase realized, he said, "My whole life I've been chasing other people's dreams. But what I loved most when I was a 5-year-old little boy was taking photos." So he abandoned being a famous soccer player. He abandoned being a prominent doctor and went on to go follow his passion and become the number one photographer in the world. And so I think it's beautiful, your story and his story and so many other wonderful stories out there, of how do we learn to listen to the voice of our soul, Carlos? How do we elevate our consciousness so we don't get distracted by the material things or the other things that might usurp our choices of wanting to really fulfill our heart's deepest desires? How did you do it?
I had no choice. The events that presented themselves in front of me were so obvious. Let me give you an example. How did I end up in Morocco? I see an ad in Berkeley in those bulletin boards that says, "Do you want to know the science of the talisman and of the genies?" Wow, what a proposal. Come to London. I had no way to get to London. My funds in my early 20s weren't so good as to just hop on a plane and go to London. And then I go into this bookstore that unfortunately doesn't exist anymore in Berkeley, called Shambhala. And I'm standing there, I'm looking at books of Sufism because I had been interested through correspondence. I don't know if you ever heard of Idris Shah. Idris Shah was an Afghani prince who lived in the outskirts of London and who created an institute for cultural research and was teaching Sufism, not in a religious way, but in a modern way. So I'm looking at his books there, and then one book falls off the shelf, falls on the floor, and as fast as I was going to pick it up, this other guy with a big beard and a turban picks it up and says, "This is a gift for you." And I say, "A gift for me?" "Yes, I am the author." And this man that wrote a book called The Book of Strangers facilitated my arrival in Morocco, where I stayed for almost 11 months. Completely surrendered to the fact that was my next step. In those days, there was no email and there was no WhatsApp, and the phone calls were expensive. And I had to call my parents and say, "I'm staying in Morocco." "Why are you staying in Morocco?" "So I'm learning." And I thought I was going to stay forever. And one day, after about 11 months, I was offered to go to Egypt, to go to another, what do you call it, another group, another association of Sufism. And it was right for me not to go. And so here I have hundreds of people praying out loud while I'm making the decision. And the obvious mental decision is, of course, "Thank you very much, I'm going there." And I come out of this meditation and I say, "No, I'm going back to the West." And I didn't go to Egypt at that time. And the leader of the group, the Sheikh, said, "May that be the will of Allah." And that was the will of Allah. And I only went back. And this is something that you might enjoy. When I went there, I missed the train. So here I was in the old city of Meknes, the Medina of Meknes, asking with my 4 words of Arabic, "Where is the house of so-and-so?" And people would spit at me, spit, literally spit at me, because Sufism in the culture of Islam is not a positive. It is a mystical thing, and therefore it is away from realizing concrete things in people's life. And then one guy in a covered jalaba with a hood on his head grabs my hand and pulls me and takes me to a place, and I'm surrendered, walking. And when I arrived there, a little kid, 7-year-old, opens the door and says in Spanish, "You finally made it. Thank the blind man." And I look, and this man had no eyes, had literally no eyes. And he had taken me there to my place where I spent almost a year. Now, many years later, this was in the early 70s, in the early 90s, I led a group there because I wanted to have people share the experience of the mystical aspects of Morocco, not the touristic or the the economic aspects that are so focused by tourists. And this man, the blind man, finds me again and takes my hands and kisses them and smells them. And he says, it is so good to feel, not to see, to feel that you're back. Mm. And my life has been full of those non-planned events, but planned in my imagination, at least, by some superior order, like you mentioned, the higher self or the divine part of ourselves that has a plan laid out, or so I want to believe, has a plan laid out, but there is no way of demonstrating it, that it is really a laid out plan or a series of synchronicities.
That's a great question. How do we ride the wave of synchronicities and notice when we're being redirected? You could have just as easily gone to Egypt. I find this so interesting. I had a dear friend years ago who was in an abusive relationship, literally physically abusive, verbally abusive relationship. And the universe, much like the universe pushed you to go to Morocco, gave you the book, gave you the people, the resources. In the opposite way, every time she went to go see this man who lived a little ways away from her, she would get in a car accident. She would fall down the stairs. Like literally the universe was saying, stop, turn around, go home. Do not pass go. Do not go to this man's house again. And it took her 2 years of missing these signals and signs that she was on the wrong path in order to eventually find the love of her life and her husband. So how do we know, Carlos, how do we know when we're meant to go to Egypt as a metaphor or when we're meant to go back to the West? How do we follow the signs and know when we should be riding the wave of synchronicity and serendipity and when we should be turning around and going a different direction?
I find that we have to listen to a voice of silence that is within our hearts. People say gut level feeling. Maybe it's a gut level feeling. Maybe it's a heart level feeling. But it is very insistent. This is yes and this is no. At least that's the way I've experienced it. And sometimes we take a detour. Sometimes we don't listen for the first time. Like I had a not so good experience with a bank. The first time I saw the guy, I saw him stealing money from a cashier. And then I said to myself, oh, don't be so paranoid. He's a certified American banker. So on and so forth. But you robbed me. Years later, I found out you robbed me. So why didn't I not listen in that first moment? Because of lack of confidence, confidere, with faith that what is coming from inside, the information is important, is valuable. But I censored myself. I invalidated my first perception, and I paid seriously for that. And I paid it in many sense.
Mm. Yeah, I think that it can't be emphasized enough of finding the time to listen in the stillness. So many people often ask, how do we reconnect to our higher self? And we can't hear it. The noise is so loud between the distractions of our phone and the media and life. We're constantly being pinged at and ringed and buzzed and so many things that we don't give ourselves permission to sit in the quiet right. Stillness and silence. I've noticed some of my most profound connections have come in hours or days of silence where you just spend time with your phone off, not talking to anybody, and just allow all the noise that's followed you your whole life to quiet down. So tell us a little bit more, Carlos, about your journey of consciousness and to what it's having you do and what you're being called to do today.
When people have asked me, what do I see in my future? I've never imagined things. I've always seen light, a golden light that is like an attractive magnet. Yes, an attractive magnet that when I look at the future, I don't have any ambitions. I don't have any plans that are being laid out in one way or another. But plans are being presented to me. Like now, I'm not from a generation of social media. And yet everybody around me says, you have to have more social media. So suddenly people have come into my life to present that to me and educate me. And all I have to do is learn and appreciate it, not with the expectation that this is going to be a big event, but with the expectation of, why am I being told to learn this now? What is important for me and for my journey and for my service? And that's the word I want to underline. If one goes in service in this life, then everything arranges itself according to the best pictures of reality. When one goes with an ulterior motive, then things don't arrange themselves that way. And I've had both experiences. I remember back in the 80s, I created this foundation called the World Health Foundation for Development and Peace. And I put my work under that, especially in South America, where people that would participate in my seminars or my retreats had a commitment to dedicate an exact number of hours of what they thought they had learned to bring it to people that would never listen to a tape or to a digital transmission today, or even read a book. Orphans, people in nursing homes, people in prisons. And we had a lot of that in the 80s in Latin America with the dictatorships that were taking place. The exchange that I created there was, you studied 20 hours with me, please donate 20 hours to go to an orphanage and bring about the distilled message, not the complicated words, but the distilled message. And I was just sharing this with somebody yesterday, that 7, 8, 9-year-old kids, that we would have to go to this orphanage with a toy or with some clothes or with some food. They would write us cards, and I still have the cards saying, please take your toys and your gifts back, because what you have given us is not measurable in these toys. You have given us back our sense of humanity. Mm. 8-year-old kids saying that. And you will need these toys to enter another orphanage, because that's the way the system goes. You can't just go and say, I want to spend some humanity time with 8-year-olds. It'll be suspicious. So you bring them a gift, especially today, that all these strange phenomena are taking place. But in those days, we would take those toys and open the doors of another orphanage. Or we would do parties in which this elderly would have grandchildren. And the grandchildren would have a granddaddy. And they would dance together and play together and serve each other as holy company. To remember that they weren't just an orphan or an elderly, but human beings in different stations needing another human beings for their own hearts.
So beautiful. It's so true that we get so caught up in these labels of orphan, old person, this person, that person. And sometimes we don't give ourselves the space. Just be humans. Could we just be one human being, spending quality time with another, listening? I think that's one of the greatest gifts that we've lost as human beings, is because we've become so detached and distracted from one another. We've forgotten how to listen and how to be with another person, let alone be with ourselves. I think first we have an opportunity to learn to give ourselves listening and quality time in order to be able to provide it to somebody else. And yes. I love what you're saying. It all does come to being of service. We'll never be able to be of service to somebody else unless we first learn how to prioritize ourselves, love ourselves. And then from that place of overflow, where we know we are enough and the world is enough, that we can then share our gifts with people.
Right. And reawaken each other to the fact that we're not here to acquire, we're here to give. Like every living species, like every tree, they're always giving. I have this privilege of having grapes here in a vineyard. And I remember the blessing, but it was a few years ago when I was collecting the grapes and there were a lot of bees. And I made a deal with the bees. And I said, I would leave you in every single tree, in every single part, some grapes for you, and I would take some for me. They never stung me. They never did anything.
Yeah, it's everything is consciousness. That's why we do the show regarding consciousness, is if we can understand and move past the illusionary sense that there's separation, there really is no separation. We and the bees have the same consciousness. In fact, I just saw, speaking of bees, I saw something beautiful on an Instagram thing. It was a gentleman, the guy who did all the famous voiceover stuff for National Geographic in the 90s. He has that beautiful British accent. And he's telling this story of how when a bee goes to a flower, it has a certain vibratory song that the flower is singing, that the flower is actually telling the bee, please come pollinate me, come take my pollen. And it creates a plus or a minus energy. And then the bee lands and that cancels the energy and it creates it neutral. And then when the bee leaves, the flower makes a different sound so another bee doesn't waste its energy there. And I was like, wow, the fact that this is all even possible, so too could we be as human beings, these receptors and collaborators with one another. And in fact, to your point about talking to the bees, something I've been speaking with a lot of the clients I work with is around soul talking. In Kabbalah, they have a concept called proactive confrontation, where let's imagine that you and I, Carlos, need to have a conversation. Maybe it's a tough conversation about family or money or whatever it might be. And what the Kabbalists teach is this idea of proactive confrontation, where I would sit in meditation and have the entire conversation I need to have in the physical world with you at the spiritual level, at the heart level first. So that way, when I go to speak to you in the physical realm, you're more receptive. It's the same thing as the bees. You talk to the bees. You said, bees, I got your backs. I'm going to take care of you. Make sure you always have all the flowers you need. You stay in your trees. We'll agree to that. The same can be done with human beings. And it's amazing. I call it soul talking, because when we pause and we connect to one another deeply at the heart, at the soul level, something becomes possible that beyond the physical words that we could ever say when we have a heart-to-heart connection with another human being before we ever engage in physical dialogue.
It's so beautiful what you're saying. And it replicates a conversation that I had with my wife just last night.
Really?
Yeah, we were talking about the dogs. And we talked to the dogs in English, in Spanish, but we don't know how to speak dog language. But they do. And they made themselves present and aware. And we're talking about what is the realm of the communication that's taking place. It's like the word says, communication as common unity. Mm-hmm. And the common unity is not the language or the symbolic representation of a language, but it's the energy with which it's transmitted. I had to go on certain medicines a little while ago, and my dogs, we have four, and they jump, and they're huge. They're over 70 pounds each. So I sat down with them, and I said, I don't need to be pushed. You can't jump on me like you used to. Give me a few months till this gets out of the system. And they haven't jumped.
Wow. It's so true, Carlos. One of my dear friends, Arlene, has a farm, a pistachio farm, out in the middle of California. And she had a beautiful dog that was a rescue, that was a very unique breed. And she had two homes. She had the pistachio ranch and she had another home in Orange County. And every time she would leave this dog, the dog would be so sad. The dog's name was Cookie. And Cookie would go chasing after Arlene every time she would leave the farm. And so I had met with this brilliant animal communicator years ago named Cindy Smith, who had said, if you ever want to communicate with an animal, you just connect with them just the way you did with your dogs. And you just share with them what they need. And I did the same thing for Arlene's dog. I didn't even know I could do this, but I meditated on the dog and I heard that Cookie was lonely and felt like she didn't have a pack. So I said, Arlene, why don't you, the next time you're at the farm, put your head near Cookie's head and just visually show her she's a part of your pack, that you're going to leave, but you're always going to come back for her. This was 7, 8, 9 years ago. Cookie lived on the farm, Carlos, until the day she died. And never once after Arlene did that, did she ever try to leave the farm again. And it's just so beautiful. Yeah. That it's all connection at the heart level. It doesn't matter what language we speak. We all speak the language of heart and love.
And we say that we have domesticated the dog, but I think the dog has domesticated us.
Yes.
We take care of them. We feed them. We walk them. The other day, one of them was jumping. We opened the door for them to go do their needs, but they wanted something else. And they stood there till they got something else. And that was water.
Yeah. They've domesticated us, absolutely. Carlos, yes. You're doing such incredible work in the world. I know you have your 23rd book coming out here soon that you're in the process of writing. Where can people connect with you, find out more about the work you're doing in the world, or learn more about the beautiful retreats you do as well in Vista?
I have a website that is going to be revamped, this revolution of social media, but it's very simple. It's drwarter.com. And there's a lot of information there and blogs and videos and podcasts and everything that needs to be reorganized, but it's available. And I do these retreats 4 times a year, every 3.5 months. And I do them here at the farm. And it's very beautiful because people that never have heard of each other at the first day already have a level of privacy and intimacy that is very rewarding. Because I think everybody's looking for themselves. And if anything can be facilitated to come closer to that I, which has no name, which has no surname, but it's the I that's eternal, from the divine to the physical, from the physical to the meta-dimensional, that we don't even know how many dimensions there are. But definitely, they're not just 3 dimensions. Mm-hmm. And I was studying some materials that I haven't touched in 50 years, which is biochemistry and embryology, and to see how we reproduce, how miraculously it is that 2 cells become one. Mm-hmm. And there is a statement, whenever 2 or more come in my name, in the divine name, then life and there's love and there's the presence of the divine. And what more presence of the divine than the reproduction that we have to become an embryo and become a fetus and become a person. And who knows what else we become after that. We want to believe that we transcend. I want to believe that we transcend. And probably we do, because we organize our pictures of reality so that we manifest. And we manifest what is for the highest, and I think for the highest good of all, not just for the highest good of the individual that is visualizing. What did I know that somebody was going to take my manuscript, which wasn't a manuscript, it was a journal, to Pablo Neruda, Nobel Prize winner in literature?
Yeah.
I can only say thank you for that.
Thank you. It's such a good reminder, Carlos, and what a beautiful way to close today's show. May we all say thank you. Thank you to the serendipities. Thank you to sometimes the forks in the road that seem to take us down a different path or a different journey that we weren't anticipating, or maybe that wasn't part of our quote-unquote plan. Could we learn to say thank you for everything that's given to us in whatever shape or form it comes? And may we have the wisdom to follow the signs, as The Alchemist, the beautiful book, once told us. Could we follow the signs that takes us home to the place that we're always destined to be? And may our hearts always know the way. So thank you.
Beautifully said. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. And thank you to each of you tuning in out there. May you follow the signs and the journeys to your destiny. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Justin, for introducing us.
Yes. Big hugs to Justin.